Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking to Aisha Khan about Pakistan. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Professor Ilan Pappe. He's a historian and co-author, along with Noam Chomsky, of the recently released book Gaza in Crisis. And he will be speaking on Wednesday, the 8th of December, at 6 o'clock at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium here in Santa Fe. He'll be discussing his work with Anthony Arnove of Haymarket Books, which is the publisher of Gaza in Crisis. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's a pleasure to be on your program. Thank you.
In the United States, questions surrounding the return of Jews to Palestine go back to the middle of the 19th century. What was the nature of the discussion at that point? Why were Americans interested in the Middle East and Palestine in particular?
There were two reasons why Americans were interested in the 19th century. One reason was religion. The American churches, especially the evangelical churches, were very keen to have a presence in the Holy Land and even to convert the people of the Holy Land to Christianity, and competed with other European churches on it. There was a great belief in the connection between presence in the Holy Land and the implementation of the divine schemes and God's plans. The other reason was more strategic. America began to be interested in a global reach, but I think that was more secondary. It was the first reason was the main one, the missionary impulse to come and have a presence. And some of these missionaries even thought that they can sell the idea of nationalism, not just of Christianity, to the Arab world. And that's why the American University in Cairo and in Beirut were such an important schools for the emergence of modern Arab nationalism.
So the idea that this whole drama, which has unfolded in the 20th and 21st centuries, was part of God's plan. I mean, what we're talking about is a set of apocalyptic beliefs that when Jews return to Israel, then the second coming of Jesus Christ will happen. And that's what foreign policy should be based on?
Well, yes, it's not only in the case of the United States. The idea of the return of the Jews to Palestine as sort of an event that precipitates the second coming of the Messiah was a basis for policy. In fact, in the United States, it was less something which influenced the policy of the United States government. It was more the deeds of individuals and of missionaries. When the American government was thrown into the picture much later on, during the Second World War, reasons were behind it. But in Britain's case, for instance, the British Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, who was behind the Balfour Declaration, the idea that Britain would support the building of a Jewish homeland in Palestine, he also believed that the return of the Jews, and one should say their future conversion to Christianity, was part of the divine scheme. So in the case of Britain, this played a role in the initial policies. I think after that, both in the case of America and Britain, other considerations motivated the support for Zionism and later for the State of Israel.
Christian fundamentalists who have played a major role later in our history in the 20th century in policymaking, and Zionist Jews seem like strange bedfellows, and yet they have made an alliance. Describe how that works.
Yes, indeed. First of all, one should stress this contradiction, because, as I said before, a very important part of the divine scheme was the conversion of Jews to Christianity, or they will burn in hell. So one would have thought that the Jewish national movement would not see people who see this as the final plan, as their partners and allies. And in many years, in fact, the sort of central labor Zionist movement shunned any close relationship with Christian fundamentalism. It was only when the present Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, was the Israeli ambassador in the United Nations in the early 1990s, that he decided to form a close alliance with the Christian Zionists, as he felt that, for one reason, the liberal Jewish voice was not supporting Israel as much as he hoped for. And if you remember, during the days of the senior Bush administration, there was a real shift in American policy towards Israel and a willingness to go very far, farther than any other administration in the history of the Arab-Israeli conflict, towards the solution of the Arab-Israeli conflict, even at the expense of exerting pressure on Israel. And that's for very pragmatic reasons, under the influence of someone like Netanyahu, this alliance became stronger and stronger as the years went by.
Going back, there has not always been, certainly in the beginning and up through the middle of the 20th century, unconditional support for the Zionist idea and then the return to Palestine to found Israel. And you describe and you talk about in your book the moment in the early 20th century when there was actually some real energy devoted in the United States toward independent self-rule in the Middle East. Tell us about that period.
Yes, indeed. The American short involvement after the first, during and after the First World War ended in 1920 when President Wilson's idea of making America a global power was rejected by both the House of Representatives and the Senate. And America went into that isolation that was only broken by the attack on Pearl Harbor many years later. But in the brief period in which America was involved in global businesses, so to speak, between, I would say, 1914 and 1920, just in those 6 years, the American administration, including the American president, took a great interest in the Middle East in general and in the Palestinians in particular. And the president, President Wilson, had sent two of his closest friends to Palestine, Mr. King and Mr. Crane, to find out what do the indigenous people of Palestine want, what is the wishes of the Palestinians in Palestine. And that was 2 years after Britain has granted the Balfour Declaration, namely promising that Palestine would become a Jewish homeland without at all paying any attention to the wishes of the indigenous people. And they came back to him and he said what the people of Palestine want was either to be independent or to be part of an Arab state, the greater Syria state. Definitely they don't want the Balfour Declaration. And they don't want allow any Jewish settlement. And if we will support it, we will. They told him we will create a conflict in Palestine between the Zionist settlers and the local native population. Of course, they were right, but nobody paid attention to them later on, and neither anyone paid attention to President Wilson because America, for a while, abandoned the international arena. When it came back in the 1940s, for a while, this was still the basic American impulse to support the indigenous people, not the colonialist movements. But this changed after the Holocaust. So up to the Holocaust, I would say, the American instinct, the instinct of the American statesmen was to see in the Palestinian movement, very much in as in the other national movements in the Arab world, legitimate movements that actually America preferred to the colonialist powers, such as Britain and France, against which these movements fought.
You describe that the whole intellectual position supporting Arab and Palestinian self-rule was a real influence, as you say, through World War II, in U.S. foreign policy establishment, in the State Department. The Israel lobby was established, as you write, to eliminate pro-Arab influence in the State Department. How was that done? What did it look like?
Yes, I should say it was done not only to eliminate the pro-Palestinian or pro-Arab sentiment in the State Department. It was founded at the time of the Eisenhower administration. Now, Dwight Eisenhower was very curious in his attitude to the Arab world. On the one hand, he is remembered in this area where I'm talking to you from, the Middle East, as someone who fought against Arab radicalism, against Jamal Abdel Nasser, against Arab nationalism. But many people forget that on the question of Palestine, in fact, he was very pro-Palestinian. He also believed that the Palestinian refugees had the right to return and wanted to pressure Israel to force it to accept the Palestinian refugees. And this is the main reason, actually, much more than the Arabist school of thought in the State Department, that prompted the Israelis to look for a lobby that could prevent in the future such American attitudes. And one should say they were very successful. It took them a few years, but I think in 1960 was the greatest success of this lobby. Nobody heard about it until 1960, but in 1960, when Senator Fulbright was trying to declare that this is not an illegal lobby, because he was violating almost every lobby law in the United States by that time, they succeeded in destroying him. And that success, I think, intimidated and terrified a lot of American senators and politicians afterwards, and the lobby became a very powerful actor in the American scene.
And as you write, they had a great deal of success in toppling any politician who was against their agenda.
Absolutely, absolutely. They were powerful enough to, and I would say reckless enough, to go to the opposition of any given candidate they didn't like. And it was even sometimes less destroying the candidate itself as much as empowering with every possible means the one that the candidate was competing with, whoever he or she were, and into whatever position they were competing for. And I think, you know, if one knows politics, and I've been myself for a short while in politics, you don't need to do it all day and all night. It's enough to have two, three very successful examples so that the others would think twice before daring to challenge you.
There is religious ideology, which we talked about earlier, there, which is this sort of strange bedfellows thing between Zionists and Christian fundamentalists. Then you have the establishment of Israel, for which there was a certain amount of sympathy after the Holocaust. There are also other issues, resource issues, including Middle Eastern oil. What is the role that oil has played in U.S. policy towards Israel and Palestine?
Yes. In many ways, one would have expected oil, actually, to make sure that America, oil could have affected the American foreign policy and directed it in some way against Israel, because Israel or Palestine do not possess oil. The oil exists in the Arab states that, at least formally, are enemies of the state of Israel. But what happened is that during the Cold War, the Arab world was divided into two clear camps. One was pro-American, and that's where the oil was. And one was pro-Soviet, where the oil wasn't. And the Americans, sometimes successfully, sometimes not so successfully, navigated between the Arab countries which were pro-American and had the oil and their commitment to Israel. I think what helped them was that these Arab regimes were not genuinely interested in the fate of Palestine. And therefore, you could hear a lot of rhetoric about the Palestinian issue, and at times it seemed like America won't be able to reconcile its support for a country like Saudi Arabia, let's say, and the state of Israel. But in practice, there was nothing that Saudi Arabia did that undermined Israel in any way, and there was nothing Israel did which undermined Saudi Arabia. So for a very long while, until today in many ways, apart from Saddam Hussein, but maybe we'll talk about him a bit later, but apart from the story of Iraq, which changed, of course, in 1958, when Iraq was no longer a pro-American state. Apart from that story, until today, you can be pro-Israeli and pro-oil-producing Arab states and even successfully survive a crisis such as the 1973 war when the Arab world declared embargo of oil against America, but this did not last long enough to have any serious impact on the American economy or on the American strategy in the Middle East.
What you're saying in some ways is counterintuitive when one hears from Israel that they are a tiny country awash in a sea of enemies.
Yes, oh, definitely. It is the largest and strongest army in the Middle East. It faces very volatile Arab regimes. Very few of them enjoy the legitimacy from their own societies. Very few of them can dare and do something either in conjunction with other neighbors or by themselves without risking the fall of their own regime. So I think, yes, I think it's a distorted picture. I think the more accurate picture is of a very strong militarized society, be it on a very small space compared to the others, who has and had in the past the ability to impact very strongly the survival of countries, their well-being, far ahead of its own borders. One should say that it would not have been able to do this as it did in Lebanon or in other places without the support of some very important elements in the American administration.
Now, let's talk about Saddam Hussein for a moment. He had a very strong anti-Israel position.
That's right. That's right. But he also was very careful. His main axe to grind, actually, was not so much the Palestine question. It was much more the Kurdish question. He suspected, and rightly, that Israel had very strong connection with the Kurdish resistance. So that was one reason. And secondly, he imagined himself to be kind of the new Jamal Abdel Nasser, and therefore he paid tribute in any way he could to the Palestinian struggle and so on. His attempt, when he was targeted by the American strategist as a danger that has to be first limited and then removed, to create a link between Israel's policies against Palestine and the American policies against him, worked for a while, or at least was seemed reasonable in the eyes of many people in the Arab societies, but was not accepted by the Arab regimes, and that's why his ploy did not work in this respect, neither in the first Gulf War and definitely in the second Gulf War.
What does the United States gain from its support of Israel, which is a very expensive proposition for the American taxpayer?
I think that all in all, the sort of the bottom line is of great losses, to my mind, to the American position in the Arab world. I say it especially as an historian. I compare the American image and position in the eyes of the Arab world leaders and intellectuals and even masses around the First World War. It looked like a young country, an anti-colonialist one, a model that excited people, a liberal democracy that they wanted to emulate in some ways, and definitely as a friend. And I look at America today, it looks like an occupying power, an imperialist power, as it has been seen for the last 30 or 40 years. There's a lot of animosity, there's a lot of hate. Yes, there is a wish to emulate some of the economic success and maybe even the lifestyle of America, but this is not out of admiration to the United States. And there's only one reason, or there's one main reason, for this absolute decline in American status in the Arab world, and this is the support for Israel. In the book with Noam Chomsky, I think we argue a little bit about it. And Noam Chomsky, as you know, probably would have added that America is its own worst enemy. It's not just the support for Israel, it's the support, and I think there's a point there as well, support for non-democratic regimes, as long as they're pro-Americans, regardless of their record of human rights and so on. And they wish to sell arms to the Arab world, and of course the whole oil question. But I think that if you look at the administration since Jimmy Carter, especially the Carter, Clinton, and the Obama administration, where, after all, human rights became important for these administrations, it is the question of Israel that disallows any genuine improvement between the Arab world and the United States.
There is a picture that is being painted of a situation in which, as you say, in some ways the United States is its own worst enemy. It is providing support to Israel at great expense to us with real trouble, both in the sense of unbelievable bloodbaths and human rights violations in Palestine, and also losing the support of not only the Arab world, but Europe also, and other countries in terms of world opinion. And what is correct me if I'm wrong on here, but it looks like what's keeping it in place is an extremely strong Israel lobby that will topple you if you oppose them, number one, and number two, some kind of apocalyptic belief in the second coming of the Messiah.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think this coalition between the Christian Zionists and the pro-Israeli lobbies is the main reason for pursuit of a policy that undermines American position. However, we should throw into the fray another element. In the book, I'm talking about the triangle which supports Israel, and we talked mainly about two legs of that triangle, the Christian Zionists and the pro-Israeli lobby. There's a third leg, and this is the neocon establishment in America, where the thinking is not religious in that respect. It's a kind of cold-blooded, if you want, strategy that believes that America either have or needs all the time to have a boogeyman. It was the Soviet Union, now it's Islam. And Israel is always ready, as a military power in the Middle East, to be the forefront in the fight against this boogeyman. Now, of course, these boogeymen are not totally invented. They, as in the case of the Soviet Union, there was a real threat sometimes to the American interests. And in the case of Islam, there was a real attack on United States soil. So they can easily show some facts, if you want, for that. But of course, I think it's a distorted picture. But this distorted picture that whoever is in a given moment the arch enemy of America is told, not necessarily by Christian Zionists, Christian Zionists and Zionists. It is also told by strategists of certain American way of thinking. And Israel is seen as the most trained and committed ally that would come and join America in this fight. Sometimes too eager, as I say in the chapter that we are talking about. Sometimes the Americans felt the Israelis were too eager and didn't want them to play a direct role in that war, whether it was in Iraq in 1992 or in Jordan and Lebanon in 1958.
So when you are a country that always wants to have a boogeyman, whether it be Islam or terrorism or communism or whatever, what is gained from that, besides being in a kind of Orwellian state of endless war?
Yes, I mean, America is such a huge continent that I suppose, first of all, when one asks the question, what is to be gained, I would sort of change it, if I may, and say, who is to gain, rather than what is gained. And I think it's very easy to point to those who gain from such a reality, beginning with the big military industries, through CIA, all kinds of organizations that deal with intelligence and national security. The whole military complex, of course, is very much a benefactor from such an imagined war or a real war. Sections of the American academia, especially in the political science, strategic studies thrive on these kinds of issues. I mean, take the Cold War studies out of American academia, take Islam out of American academia, and not much is left on humanities and social sciences. So a lot of people gain, even Hollywood gains from it. It can recreate the bad guys and the good guys, now that one cannot show American Indians or Native Americans as the bad guys in these cowboy films and so on. So I think that there is a question of who gains. I still think, especially after being so many times in the United States, that there is a large section of the American society that not only doesn't gain, as you rightly say, are paying in two ways. They pay taxes that go directly to Israel and to, if you want, to the military aggression. But this money, of course, that's the second way, comes at the expense of other things that could have been invested for the welfare of people who live in America. And I think this is the main struggle, is to show people that this tiny country called Israel, sort of around it evolves a whole strategy that that sort of pushes America into the corner in which it is today in global politics, and this has far-reaching implications on the welfare of the American society. Just think of the money that was spent on the Iraq War and the present deficit in the American budget and its implications.
And not only the deficit and its implications, the money, the way that money could have been spent for good things like education and infrastructure, but also the collective reality that we lose not only our soldiers, but we displace hundreds of thousands and kill hundreds of thousands of people who are people just like us and have lives and families. And I mean, the human rights price is incalculable.
Absolutely. I think Noam Chomsky was one of the first to track our attention, for instance, to the role of the CIA in the United States in Indonesia in order to create a regime that would be pro-American in the Cold War. And not surprising that one of the biggest Islamic, probably the biggest Islamic nation in the world, some people there feel that history and feel motivated by that history. And I think the Palestinians are also an indirect victims of this kind of policy as well, although I don't think the Americans are the main culprits in the dispossession of Palestine, but they definitely play a very important role in it.
We've talked to Mohammed Omer on this program, who had his cell phone in his hand and was walking down the streets of Gaza. Mm-hmm. We've talked to Ali Abu Nima, who was talking about the hopelessness of a two-state solution and was talking about the possibility of a one-state solution, which at this point seems very remote, at least in mainstream circles. What, in your view, is the path of peace, the path of hope, the path of human rights for Palestinians and Israelis to be able to live in harmony with one another?
Yes, I think, unfortunately, what the future holds for the near future is not, or let me rephrase it by saying that the near future doesn't look very good. It looks very bleak. In fact, I think that it may even has in it a war and bloodshed and uprising and a very unstable situation of which the Palestinians, as always, would be the main victims. This is what I think is going to happen. Definitely this is not what I want to happen. As far as my own views, I think they are very close to those of Ali Abu Nima you've mentioned. I also think that the only way of having a closure in this place, in which would allow the colonialist movement that came here in the late 19th century, Zionism, that already has three generations of people living here, to reconcile with the native people, despite of more than a century of dispossession, the only way of rebuilding any kind of confidence or a trust or a future is through a one-state solution. The two-state solution is just another means of perpetuating the oppression, the occupation, and the dispossession. A small Palestinian state, not that Israel is very willing to allow that as well. But even if it would have allowed a small Palestinian state, because it would be small in terms of people, in terms of number of people, and in terms of territory, could only satisfy a very small number of the Palestinian people. And most of the Palestinian people would still be victims of the policies of expulsion and dispossession in the last 60 years. And if you leave people in this victimhood, you cannot expect them not to continue to resist and to oppose. Nor would Israel learn the lesson that it should learn. And the lesson that it should learn, that, and that's what the two-state solution would not allow it to learn, that you cannot have a democratic state which is based on on a racial majority or ethnic majority. You cannot have this. This is not a democratic idea, that you can only have a democracy if the Jews are a majority. So some people in Israel are willing to give up territory so as to keep the Jews as a majority. Others are willing to transfer the Palestinians in order to keep the Jews a majority. The demographic of this place is such that if always you will have to expel and kill Palestinians if you want to have a Jewish majority, whether you have a Palestinian state next to you or you don't have a Palestinian state next to you. And this, the Israelis have to get rid of this racist idea. And the only way of getting rid of this idea is to recreate here a regime which has a democratic basis, not a racist basis.
What is the role of world public opinion and concern about human rights at this point in relation to Palestine and Palestinians?
I think especially world public opinion in the West, is very crucial. The Israeli political and cultural elite relies very much on its standing in the West and values very much its standing in the West, and very much like in the case of apartheid South Africa. I think if the Western society, but especially the Western governments, would send it the message that its policies are unacceptable, that its ideology is unacceptable, I think it will trigger a process of change inside the Israeli society, not to begin with, because probably the initial reaction would be more entrenchment to begin with, but I think in the long run this could be a very effective way, and a non-violent way, of changing the positions of the Israeli Jewish society. And I must tell you, since the beginning of some sort of an organized campaign, which is called the BDS campaign, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanction campaign against Israel, one can see that at least for the very small Israeli peace camp, this definitely highlighted the issues that they have to put forward and helped it to crystallize its position and I think to become more effective, although we have a very, very long way to go.
Professor Ilan Pape is a historian. He's co-author with Noam Chomsky of the book Gaza in Crisis, which was released by Haymarket Books. And Anthony Arnov of Haymarket Books will be speaking with Professor Pape this Wednesday, the 8th of December at 6 o'clock at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium here in Santa Fe. It's a free event, but it has limited seating. For tickets, call 505-988-1234. Professor Pape, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you very much.
I'd like to welcome back to the program Aisha Khan. She's a film director and producer, and she is co-organizer of ReliefForPakistan.com. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, good to be back, Mary Charlotte.
So you have been keeping us up to date for the last several months since the absolutely horrifying flooding in Pakistan, which flooded one-third of the country. And
correct.
You and a small group of women mm-hmm. pulled together your resources and above all your energies to make things happen with extraordinary results.
Yes, and I have great optimistic updates today on that. So basically what we did is this: we've started this group called Relief for Pakistan. There's about four of us who are involved full-time in it. And then we have auxiliary units. I don't want to say we're just doing it alone. There's a whole bunch of other women who are also donating time to us. And if you remember, the last time I was on the show, we had done a fundraise for $150,000 for Mercy Corps. Well, that got finished. We wrapped it up because that was our emergency relief effort.
And you raised the
$150,000. And we raised the $150,000. It went to the ground. We know exactly how it was spent. We know exactly how many blankets, water bottles, everything you can think of, you know, what was spent on from that money.
And lives were saved.
And lives were saved, absolutely. So the next thing we did is we actually were contacted by one of the tribal chiefs whose area has been very severely hit in Pakistan. And a lot of the major relief agencies haven't been there. So he contacted us because of Relief for Pakistan and said, you know, I would really love it if you guys would consider helping out our area because we've got about 4 villages and about 30,000 people who've been affected. So we agreed. We've been having conversations with him for the last couple of months, and we, you know, started looking at rebuilding houses, dikes, etc. in that area. Of course, this is a learning curve, and it's very interesting. I think it kind of is the Greg Mortensen example where he went to build a school, and they told him first build the bridge.
So that people can walk across the bridge to get to the school.
Exactly. So we went thinking we're going to start, you know, rebuilding the housing, which has been lost, which is close to 3,000 houses. And instead, the tribal chief went and spoke to the people on the ground, and we kind of made them do a survey of what is your prime need right now. And they said, we want to plant seeds because we need to go into the ground now. They're an agricultural society, and they need to be able to plant seeds so that they can have a wheat crop next spring. So the last month, basically, we've been trying to network through our connections and stuff to try and figure out how we can manage this and do this. And we
so they didn't have their seeds because their seeds had been washed away by the flood?
All washed away, of the wheat storage, everything, the extra grain, everything gone. So we started, you know, networking amongst ourselves about how can we do this, and they told us what it would cost. It would be about a $250,000 raise. And we agreed to raise that money for them for farmers whose land holdings was less than 10 acres. Because we don't want to be doing it for bigger landlords. We want to be doing it for really the small, you know, farm holdings in Pakistan, which have been completely washed away. We announced our drive on November 18th. And through our connections and in-kind donation, we have achieved the goal. And in fact, it's crazy. I got the numbers today. We've managed to plant 3,400 acres. And basically, that number comes up to $380,000, which is mind-boggling.
In donations.
In-kind donations.
Donations of seeds,
we
fertilizer.
We were very, very lucky that Ruhi Foundation, which is actually part of the UN's FAO program, they listened to our plea. We also got Imran Khan, who's a very famous cricketer and who's been fundraising a lot for
cricketer?
Flood relief. Cricketer. He's done huge fundraising for the flood relief. We contacted his foundation. He said, yes, we have extra seed we can donate. And by all of it, you know, tallied, we have managed to, this week, deliver to them plantings 3,400 acres. And it's done. I mean, we can't actually digest it ourselves yet.
So you started this less than a month ago, 3 weeks ago.
November 18th is when we announced this drive.
And in 3 weeks, you have gotten 34. And so the people got the seeds that they needed. They planted
them.
Seed.
We have documentation. We know exactly how many bags were given to which farmer. I mean, because Ruhi is very, I mean, it's the UN. You know, it's an auxiliary kind of unit of the UN. So everything is documented. And the seed is being planted right now.
I am sitting in the presence of awesomeness.
I swear. We were just shocked. We were just shocked over and it all happened over Thanksgiving, by the way.
Yeah.
Which we thought was wonderful.
Yeah.
Because that's when we all had time to really focus on it and, you know, be punching the phone calls and what have you to Pakistan.
And so this is done. So then the seeds are in the ground. You wait for the crops to come up. And so your next project is, in fact, you're going to go to the housing issue.
Well, that's what we thought. So then we went back to the tribal chief and we said, okay, great. Now let's focus on the housing issue. And he said, no, I've done another survey. And the farmers really need the dike systems which were kind of like mini levees around this river, which has overflooded. They really need the dike system repaired because they're worried that this will happen all over again next year. So we're like, okay, so we're not doing the houses yet. So I've been on the phone with contacts of mine in Pakistan, as well as the other women involved, about trying to get structural engineers involved who will give us some kind of pro bono assessment. They are doing assessments on the ground themselves because obviously they've been through this before, flooding, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And the next fundraiser is going to be to repair the dikes.
Now, you were telling me the other day when we were talking before this conversation on the air today, mm-hmm. that you know somebody who had foreseen this, built the dike around their village mm-hmm. in such a way that when the whole country was flooded, that village didn't flood.
Absolutely. It's the same area. It's the tribe. You see, it's one particular ethnic group and then their tribal chiefs. It's very similar to the natives. You know, we have different tribes and different names and what have you. So this particular tribal chief that we are dealing with, he's got jurisdiction over, let's say, two or three villages in his area. And then there's three, four outerlying villages, which are his cousin's jurisdiction, right? He had, because he's an MIT grad, gone back, I think, 10 years ago and started reinforcing these dikes. So his immediate village didn't get the amount of flooding that the rest of the villages did. The reason he reached out to us for help is because the outerlying villages, those people got completely flooded, and they've now moved into his village.
Right.
Because that's the only dry land available.
I think part of what's important to acknowledge here for a moment is that some of what you're doing is not just providing relief, seeds, fertilizer, prevention of future flooding. You're also educating us. I mean, we don't usually think of Pakistani tribal chief and MIT graduate.
I know.
In the same brain space.
But the reason I got involved so heavily is because I'm from the same ethnicity. I'm a Baloch, okay, which is very, I mean, when I meet the natives, you know, Native Americans here, it's funny, we have a lot in common, just from a tribal mentality even. And I'm also exactly like this tribal chief from that kind of a family system. And I went to Mount Holyoke.
Right.
And I went to the United World College. So it's interesting. It's like the perception of Pakistan has been so narrowed in the media here. They have no idea that it's still a country with 180 million people.
180 million people, a lot of diversity, mm-hmm. not only ethnic, and cultural diversity, but I mean, it's a cosmopolitan country in a lot of sectors of it.
Very cosmopolitan country. I mean, it's not, I mean, it's always interesting to me because I've been to India and I love, my best friend is Indian. Let me just give my little disclosure here. Okay. But when I went to Bombay, I couldn't believe it. The disparity that I saw there, I never saw that in Pakistan.
Of poverty and wealth.
Of poverty and wealth.
And in Pakistan, it's not as bad?
It's not as bad. It's bad, but it's not as bad. Okay.
Very interesting.
So it's interesting to me how images of countries just, you know, just never, we never get the full narrative. We only get the headlines.
Right. And we get the stereotypes, and we also get the influence of whatever the political agenda is of the people in power.
Exactly. I mean, right now with this whole WikiLeaks thing happening, we're getting a lot of dosages of, you know, how this agenda is maintained.
So, okay, so people are listening right now, maybe from Los Alamos or maybe from whatever. If there are structural engineers listening to the show or people who know structural engineers, are you actually looking for people to...
Please contact us. Yeah, we'll take any help, advice, anything. I mean, one of the things I'm doing on behalf of the tribal chief, what we're going to start doing is, I know people who've gone through MIT in New York City, right? I'm going to outreach to them and say, what is your network and how can we do this? And can we create some kind of tour that we can all go together back to Pakistan to this area and start looking at all the different pieces that need to be rehabilitated? Because I think that's a great story, like you said.
Yeah.
He went to MIT.
Right.
And he's got a network of people.
So in order to do the rebuilding or building mm-hmm. of these dikes so that the flooding doesn't happen every year, because, I mean, this is a serious problem and an apparent manifestation of climate change.
Absolutely, yes.
You know, nobody can mess around with this stuff anymore. I mean, measures have to be taken that haven't had to be taken in the past. How much of what you need right now and in the coming year is for this water, for this dike project, is human beings with knowledge? How much of it is money and materials? What's that looking like?
I think it's both, because what we realized through this particular, you know, with the seed donation, it's like we didn't have to get into a fundraising drive. We were able to tap into our networks with Ruhi Foundation and Imran Khan's foundation, and suddenly the seed was available because they had, you know, fundraised a lot and everything. So what we're finding is that we need to develop a participatory network of people that we can tap into. For example, we are beginning to start on the housing issue, and we've been speaking to another MIT grad who's got a company, and they've done pilot projects in the earthquake area in Pakistan, where she's creating insulation out of waste, which brings the temperature in housing down 10%, and in the winter times, the temperature goes up by 10 degrees.
Right.
And maintains the warmth.
It's like the shredded newspaper that people are using here.
They're exactly using paper.
Yeah.
You know, it's paper waste.
It's really good insulation.
Yes. And so we've been talking to her, that how are we going to incorporate her into the housing? Because the idea is exactly what you're saying. It's time to start thinking about these things long term. Because you don't want to be dealing with this problem all over again next year or 2-3 years from now. So it's really time to start incorporating sustainable practices in what we're doing. If we want to start addressing these issues, that this is going to, climate change is here.
And this is something that the people that you're working with in Pakistan understand very well.
Yes, because they have felt the brunt of it this time.
Yeah.
They get it. So we're getting a lot of local support from this tribal chief and his, you know, entire council and everything. They get the issues. Which is why they've come to us and said, okay, fine, we need to repair the dikes first.
I just want to commend you, and we'll be talking to you in the future on the air about the ongoing projects there, because it fascinates me so much. But this is such an example of what, I don't like it when people say, you know, the impact that one person can have, but the impact that a small group of people working together can have
is extraordinary. I have to say yes, because none of us, well, one or two of us have been involved with NGOs before, but I don't have an NGO background. I'm a filmmaker.
Right. You
know? But I realized that through the contacts that we have, you can make a difference. And I have to
commend a huge difference.
Huge difference. And I have to tell you, even being on the air here makes a huge difference. Because we know with the lack of the media coverage, we rely on radio shows like this to get the word out about what we're doing.
Albuquerque to Taos metropolitan area.
Absolutely, because the donations that have come in from this show, every time I've been on this show, confound us. And, you know, I'm going to give my email address again this time. Because people actually wrote to me last time and said, we want to be ongoing and updated, and please let us know how else we can help and stuff. And it's really, again, back to community. Santa Fe, Albuquerque, Taos, wherever anybody's listening, there is a community. And we feel affected by somebody else, you know, going through something like this.
Well, the website is relieffor.pakistan.com, and the 4 is the number 4. So relieffor.pakistan.com. And what is your email address?
My email address is indusvalley, I-N-D-U-S, Valley, V-A-L-L-E-Y, at mac.com, mac.com.
Mac.com. Aisha Khan is a film director and producer, co-organizer of relieffor.pakistan.com. Thank you for being with us, and we look forward
to talking
to you again in the new year.
Absolutely.
Excellent.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.